I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Our Vayikra series, Kedushas in the Details, explores the way the laws in the book try and elevate each of our most basic human functions: food intake, bodily functions, relationships, spaces of worship, and time. This year, I'll be taking a particularly honest and candid look at the way these laws do or do not get function in our lives. I remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website or contact the office directly. Parshat Metzorah focuses on bodily impurities. These are the types of impurities that can be rectified and remedied with a process that includes waiting a period of time, immersion in a mikvah, and in some cases, bringing sacrifices. These are distinct from the impurities that have no remedy, like the prohibited sexual relations that leave a permanent stain, that are presented as sins in the more classic sense. The bulk of the Parsha treats tzara'at, a skin disease which can impact the individual and their house, and in this case also speaks about the ways to remedy these situations. The final chapter of the Parsha addresses the ramifications of certain bodily emissions that render someone impure: a zav, which is an unusual penile emission, a zava, a regular non-menstrual bleeding, seminal emissions, which impurify both the man and the woman, and the nida, the menstruant woman. My guest today is Batya Pribor, who was a certified nurse midwife and a certified practitioner of Chinese medicine, which includes acupuncture and herbal medicine. She is also a certified EFT, or tapping, practitioner. She has a private practice in Jerusalem and Gush Etzion. She also has spent years learning in Batei Midrash and frequently teaches in her community. Batya, it is a pleasure and an honor to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
So we're going to do this episode a little bit differently, just sort of explaining to our listeners. I want to start with a bit of an introduction about this Parsha and to discuss Tzara'at, because in last week's episode, we really focused on the birthing woman and we didn't talk at all about Tzara'at. And I think that introduction will really help explain why I've invited you today on the podcast. So I want to start a little bit to talk about Tzara'at. I think most importantly, what I want to say is that Tzara'at is not leprosy. Okay, Tzara'at is not Hansen's disease as we often think today, which is a horrible disease which has tremendous traditions surrounding it and societies that it really ruptured and created tremendous disharmony in. The word leprosy doesn't appear anywhere until the Hellenistic period. The belief is that because Alexander's army came back from India with this disease, and it gets confused only in the 9th century when an Arab physician, John of Damascus, refers to leprosy by the term lepra, which is then used to translate Tzara'at, also an earlier text, but the term for leprosy is actually eliphas, okay, which is today what we call Hansen's disease. And so by way of a whole bunch of mistranslations and misconceptions, we look at Tzara'at often as leprosy, but it isn't. And if you look at the plain verses in the Torah, it's kind of a catch-all name for a whole bunch of skin diseases, for balding phenomenon. It's not just at all what we will think of as these white, sort of scaly, the actual leprosy, which eats away at the skin. In addition, the treatment period that we use, whether it's a week or a few days to see whether this disease has spread, also is completely irrelevant when it comes to any of the real skin diseases we see. It's not enough time for things to get better. Skin diseases usually take a much longer time to actually be remedied. And so there were different sort of suggestions that scholars brought up over the years. Maybe it was a kind of psoriasis or a fungus, but none of the qualities described in the Torah actually fit with the way those diseases express themselves. So everyone, including the scholarly world and the Parshanim, basically assumed that we do not know what Tzara'at is. And all these laws, like I would say many laws in the book of Vayikra, don't necessarily have any practical import in our lives in the way that we function today. I would say that the Anchor Bible, which just to all my listeners, I would say that if you're looking for somewhat academic commentary, it's probably the best one on Vayikra. It's Professor Jacob Milgram's, probably his magnum opus, is his commentary on the book of Vayikra. And he just calls it scales disease, meaning he was being really rogue and anti-countercultural and didn't translate it as leprosy. He said, because that was just the most common feature to most of what we're describing in these parshiot. Many of both the commentators, but more modern commentators, and also in the scholarly world, like much of the topic of Tumah, they connect specifically the Metzorah to someone who exhibits many attributes of a dead person, of a corpse. And that relates both to the characteristics of how we sort of diagnose this disease and also relates to the things we tell them that they can't do, whether they have to be separate from the community or they have to cover their mouth or different things that we actually, they have, they overlap with different mourning rituals. Obviously, somebody having white marks on their body also slowly makes them look like somebody who's lost a sense of their life or a sense of their vitality, because their body is wasting away, and this really resembles death. In addition, I think this really connects to a lot of the broader theories on what is tum'ah, which we often say that the sort of commonality between different types of impurities is some sort of loss of life. And we say it both when it comes to loss of uterine blood, which is to a certain degree a loss of life. Even the woman who gives birth, she of course, please God, is living. Listen to last week's episode. But the life that was inside of her is now no longer there. So in addition to having all of these bodily emissions, she also has parted ways with a life that was growing inside of her. So there's a diminution of life to a certain degree. And also in general, the Tanakh looks at blood as the life source. So anytime blood leaves the body, it is to a certain degree a loss of life. Okay, I want to just bring up two elements. One is the really familiar idea from Chazal, which is that tzaraat is a disease that comes upon people because of sin. Okay, and I want to bring it to you in the words of Radatz Hoffman, who's actually going to disagree with this idea completely. But he says that he brings in the Gemara Masechet Erchin. There's a few places you can look at it. He says, "Al shiv'a dvarim nega'im ba'im." Right, a person is afflicted with these kind of body sores or afflictions for seven reasons: al lashon hara, v'al shvichut damim, v'al shvuat shav, v'al giloy arayot, v'al gasut haruach, v'al hagezel, v'al tzarat ha'ayin. It's sort of many, many different sins. I would even say it's a list for all sins. Okay, there's murder. Okay, there's the big one of Lashon Hara, which we're more familiar with because of the story of Miriam. We have someone swearing, you know, taking an oath that isn't true, or that we have Giloy Arayot, some sort of sexual sins. And we have also personality, I would say, deficits. Gasut Ruach is somebody, let's say, who is approaching this world with, sometimes with haughtiness, it's described, or with just a lack of gentility, for stealing, for somebody who's miserly. And Radatz Hoffman, he really takes great issue with this. And I'll just read one paragraph of what he says. He said, "In truth, if every affliction served as a punishment for sin, then why should the affliction of tzaraat not also come as a punishment for certain sins? However, just as on the other hand, there are extraordinary cases where tragedies befall people without any possible ways of seeing them as a result of sin, so too instances of tzaraat can occur in extraordinary fashion," meaning it's not necessarily because it's connected to any problems or any issues or sins that people committed. He even then brings in that Chazal sometimes say that there are cases where tzaraat just becomes, yisurin shel ahava, meaning it's a way that sort of just suffering so that we make ourselves better people, which is perhaps hinting to the idea that some people take their suffering and try and find meaning and make meaning out of it for themselves. And he says that it's difficult to understand why specifically tzaraat generates any tumah, whereas other diseases, which also generally come as a punishment for sins, do not generate tumah. He says it doesn't make sense. He doesn't at all accept Chazal's opinion. What does he say instead? He says that שצרת אינה מתאמת מתוך שהיא תוצאת החטא, אלא משום מפני המחלה, בדומה לזיווה, הם דמותו הסמלית של החטא. He says it comes in to be a paradigm of sin. It's not because you sinned and therefore you deserve to be punished, but it reminds us that the sins that we do in this world have manifestations, meaning they manifest in our bodies, they manifest in our lives. And so it's like a symbolic educational method as opposed to being a direct response to sins that people did, because we know people sin all the time and that doesn't happen to them. And so he says, "הרי היא משמשת דוגמה לאותן עבירות שנראות מיד בגופה של מדינה אשר לקטה בהן ואשר מחריבות מעט מעט את כל הבניין שלה." He says, just like sins chip away at society and they destroy the world we're in. So that's the image that we're supposed to have when we see a body slowly being chipped away by all these kinds of physical maladies. And he says this is why a person has to then leave society, because this also is like sin. We have to get sin out of society. And so it becomes a symbol, but it's not because they personally have sin. And that's how he sort of rectifies this idea. The last piece I want to say, and then I really want to hear what Baya has to say about all this, is the Rambam. And the Rambam basically brings in this gradual idea, which has no basis in the text, but I think it's very interesting. And he says, what's the connection between like these body afflictions and Tzaraat on the house and Tzaraat on clothing? And he says, well, it's a gradual process. And he says, it's actually in the end of his Mishnah Torah and Hilchot Tzaraat and Hilchot Negaim. But he says that, well, it starts with the external affliction. It starts with the home and then the garment and then on the person. We start with something far away to sort of give you a sign, something here's wrong, something here's going wrong. And then slowly, if a person keeps doing all these sins, which he does go with Chazal's idea, then it'll afflict their body. So he does go along with this sin idea, but he sort of has a very creative way to understand the correlation between the different ways that Tzaraat can afflict us. I just spent the last few minutes sort of, I would say, almost debunking the way that we usually think of Tzaraat, because we're very devoted students of Chazal. And we usually think of Tzaraat, we assume that it's some sort of punishment, it's some sort of message that's sent from God to us. And while I've sort of explained a different avenue of how one could understand this, I really thought of inviting you, Batya, for this conversation, because I think that there's a really meaningful sort of opening here to have conversation about what disease can mean for us, how we can look at disease. You know, I've come to you just one-on-one privately in your practice. I'm not embarrassed to say that at all. And I, my audience doesn't know this because this is not a part of my life that at all makes it onto the air. But I would say that what the world calls quote unquote alternative medicine is actually my family's sort of first response. That's how we deal with our lives. I'm not your classic, what people like to call crunchy advocate, but it's just because they don't know those parts of me. They're very dominant. They make it into a lot of my teaching. And I wanted to have you on because I think that you're such a great person to be able to have this conversation. Again, whether we think that Tzaraat is a punishment or isn't a punishment, I think that this is a really meaningful opening to think together about what it means for us. How do we respond to it? What might it be reflecting about our lives?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I just want to talk about Tzaraat for a second. The Sfat-Emet comments that what happens in Tzaraat is that the or that we have, the skin, and he says that the word or is milshon iver, which means like a covering up or a blinding, and that usually our skin is our partition or our levush or the thing that kind of covers us up and separates us from the world, and doesn't really allow people to see what's going on underneath. And what happens in Tzaraat, and whether we want to say that the sin for Tzaraat is specifically Lashon Hara, or any of the sins that you listed from Rav David Zvi Hoffman, what ends up happening is that what's going on internally, right, the disconnect that we have internally, because every sin that is done is basically because there's some kind of internal disconnect, right? Someone's not properly aligned with his tafkid in the world, with his neshama. So when somebody sins, it's really because there's some kind of imbalance or disconnect inside. And what happens with Tzaraat is that disconnect is actually being shown to the world and being expressed through the skin. So I just thought that was a really interesting way of seeing it. And I want to also say that it a little bit connects in my mind to an ikaron in Chinese medicine, because in another place, the Sfat-Emet talks about how the connection between speech and the skin, and how the speech is connected to our lungs, and we should be using our lungs and our speech for positive things. And obviously, with Lashon Hara, someone did not do that. But it's interesting because in Chinese medicine, the lungs and the skin are intimately connected. And I thought that was just really an interesting, you know, idea. The idea in Chinese medicine is that that the lungs represent our interface between the outside and the inside, right? Because the air that we breathe is coming in from the outside and interfacing then with our cells, and we bring the oxygen in. But it's really like our internal skin. And obviously our skin on the outside is our interface between, you know, me and the outside world. And there's an intimate connection between lungs and the skin. And in Chinese medicine, the lungs and the intestine are connected. So because the intestine is also the division inside of us between me and not me, right? Because the food that we eat is actually external. And whatever's inside the intestine is actually the outside world. And it's the intestinal wall is the connection between, is the barrier between what's outside of me, which is actually inside the intestine, and my insides, which is actually me. And all those are connected. And I wanted to say that those ideas have kind of like entered into really the West conventional Western view, where, you know, if somebody has atopic dermatitis, in Hebrew, mm-hmm. that's called asthma shel ha'or, mm-hmm. right? So already we see that a skin disease is called asthma shel ha'or. And if you're familiar with, you know, functional medicine, there's a lot of discussion about leaky gut, mm-hmm. when the walls of our intestine are not, you know, the wall is compromised, and the things that should be staying inside the intestine kind of leak out, and often that causes problems with the skin.
So, Bhatti, in the description you've given, which we're going to go back in time a little bit for a minute, I want to just also you to explain to everyone who are you and what brought you into these worlds. But it just reminds me also, this is like such a basic idea that I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, wow, how did I ever not think about this? But how the word disease is dis-ease, meaning that when somebody is ill, that it is, you know, again, people might be listening who this is a very new language or something that is something they're not familiar with, and they're like, what are you all talking about? And we're gonna sort of jump in more linearly soon, but I think that even in like I just want to point out, even in like the ways that we all speak, no matter what kind of healing you go for, there, as you said, like asthma, you know, asthma shel ha'or, which is a reflection of your breathing that is, or the not healthy breathing that's reflecting itself on your skin, even just the word disease that we use also reflects something very deep about, we may not realize, we may not believe it exactly in the way we're describing it, but it also reflects this idea that there's something of the spirit that's being reflected in what's happening, whether you want to treat the spirit or not in terms of how to deal with it. I think that many of us, certainly I feel like in Israel, there's a tremendous openness to all this, even more than in other places, that we're treating multiple levels in general when things are going wrong.
Although I think right now you just made a jump, because I was just saying that there is a connection between what's happening in the lung, what's happening in the skin, what's happening in the large intestine, what's happening mm-hmm. in the skin. And those are pretty mainstream ideas, right? The idea of asthma shel ha'or is that there is something, that there's something about the skin that relates to the idea of lung, but I never mentioned spirit. Okay. Right. So you kind of brought that in, which I think is great, but I didn't say that.
Okay. Right. So let's go back in time for a second. I just want you to sort of, you know, you're American. You mm-hmm. made Aliyah from New Jersey, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly. And I kind of imagine, but maybe I'm wrong, that you didn't grow up with Chinese medicine in New Jersey. Okay. Right. So I guess I'm a little bit curious, just if you can briefly tell us biographically, because I do think that while there are a few people out there who grew up in a home where other forms of healing were practiced, they're in the minority. And most of us who espouse, dabble, or treat with these methods went through some kind of journey that kind of brought us into that space. So I know that we could spend the whole episode talking about that journey, but I wonder if you could just share it with us a little bit, how you got to those spaces before we talk more about healing.
Yeah. I feel like I took the longer path. So I grew up in a very conventional home. My mother was a nurse in the operating room who had wanted to be a doctor, and basically brought me up, and it was very clear that she wanted me to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time resisting that. At the same time, I was kind of interested in everything, but specifically in, I think I would call it now, spiritual things, but I didn't have the words for that then, but in things where, you know, you have to look a little bit deeper. So I was drawn to physics, which is all about forces in the world that you can't actually see, mm-hmm. And math. And I also loved learning Torah. And so all those things were paths that I started to take. I have a degree in computer science, which is kind of funny. And at the same time, I was interested in what creates health, because I watched family members be ill and be treated by conventional medical routes, which don't actually create health. And I think that was one of the things that was really important to me, to try to kind of find it. Like, what is the thing? What is like the underlying truth behind what actually creates health? And I think that that's probably the question that really spurred me to go and learn all the different things I learned. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like I was like gathering skills along the way. And here I am now. And I look back and feel like, you know, I didn't see my path clearly. Like some people kind of say, I'm going to go to medical school when they know what their path is when they start. And for me, it was much more intuitive and kind of a little bit like groping in the dark to kind of find my path. But now I look back and I see, wow, I'm exactly where I'm meant to be, where I'm meant to be. And I've kind of discovered and put together this toolbox that's really unbelievably powerful to be able to help people find healing.
I guess it depends how many hours we have today, how I want to respond to each of these. I guess I'll just take this opportunity because, again, my listeners have no idea that, like, this is something that I dabble in, like, completely. Again, not as a practitioner, as a user. And I do a lot of triage, helping people find the right tools. And actually, it's a hidden dream of mine. And my husband knows about it. Now, apparently, all of you guys will know about it, that I actually really want to make a podcast doing this, where I speak with different practitioners and specifically geared towards helping parents figure out how to help their children heal from a lot of the mainstream regular childhood things that we very often, because of difficulty of time and patience and money and just a lack of familiarity with the different modalities out there, to try and help them navigate like what might be a good address for all these different things that come up constantly with children. That's just a sidebar. I do hope one day I'll do it. It's just not something that I've been able to fit into my life right now. I just want to chime in with you and say that I relate to that description of being a kid who was always looking to see things that we couldn't see very much. And I did find it in like my religious life. No one told me to be a doctor, but I thought I was going to be a doctor. I started out pre-med and then I dropped it because I don't like learning science. And the truth is, though, that my journey into these worlds actually started with a non at all threatening like things with my own health that I wanted to deal with when I was first pregnant and had terrible allergies and like couldn't take any medicines, which anyways had never helped in the past. And it was actually my first foray into all this. And now at this point, it's been, I don't know, 13 years, and the whole experience of life in trying to do this through with my children has been really eye-opening. And that idea, I just want to share one personal story about seeing, I also have a tremendous amount of illness in one side of my family. And I think my listeners know that my father passed away a few years ago. And I really relate to that description of, I think that we all have to know that there is tremendous, I want to say this at the outset, there's tremendous gifts of life that conventional medicine and Western medicine has brought to the world. Life-saving, you know, if you break your arm, acute issues, I think you're amazing, Batya. They shouldn't come to you initially. They need to go to the hospital and they need to go fix it.
For sure.
Of course.
Yes.
And I just want to say that there's a difference between like the acute life-saving medicine that we're seeing literally saving lives right now every day. And there's all these other modalities, which especially when it comes to chronic issues that people struggle with, that modern medicine really, they don't have those tools. They have symptom controlling or creating, trying to temper a situation. But what you're describing is that there's all these different modalities out there that are trying to promote health or to even eliminate a disease to a certain degree. Again, I'm thinking of smaller scale things. And then also these modalities can be used as supportive modalities while also using some of the amazing discoveries that have brought to the world because of Western medicine. So I just want to like put that on the map here, that this is not like any, there is no bashing going on. That's not the approach of either of us. But I think that still bringing some of this to light is something that's really, really important, because I think a lot of people out there, we know, statistically, a lot of people are suffering. There's much more medicine that's being used than ever before, whether it's, you know, physical wellness or emotional wellness and the connection between those. And I think a lot of people are seeking healing, and there's a lot of openness to a lot of different ways to try and come about that. I want to know if you could just describe a little bit for our listeners, what are the kinds of things you deal with, right? For somebody who's never been to an acupuncturist, or they've been, but they've never really been explained to. I find that, by the way, a real Achilles heel with a lot of alternative practitioners, that they're not very good at explaining what they're doing. And it creates like this mystery, which for some people makes them feel supported, and for other people it makes them feel like they're left in the dark. There's a little sometimes a little bit of lack of transparency about what's going on. And so I'm wondering if you could explain to us, what is it that you do kind of on a daily basis in your clinic?
So first of all, I want to say, if you ask me to kind of like reduce what I do to kind of a soundbite, I would say that I try to facilitate root cause healing, meaning I'm always trying to figure out when somebody comes into my clinic, what is the root cause here? And sometimes there's one thing and sometimes it's a number of things, because we understand that health isn't always linear. And then I try to figure out what's the best way to get them to where they want to go. And then I use the different skills that we talked about, or that you mentioned before. We didn't talk about them yet. But so I almost always use acupuncture because it's just so effective. And I often will then add to it something, a new technique that I've learned, which is an allergy elimination technique, which I find to be super amazingly effective also. And I can explain a little bit more about that if you want to hear a little bit more about that. Sometimes I'll recommend a person do use the EFT, the tapping. I don't usually have time in a regular session to incorporate that. I do sometimes do private sessions with the EFT. But I would say that in my mind, what I'm always trying to think is, and what we're always trying to do, is stimulate the body to heal itself. Because the body is incredibly powerful and incredibly resilient. And I feel like that's part of the gifts that Hashem gave us when he created us. And so that's really always what I'm trying to do, is figure out where the disruption is and then restore the natural flow and give the body the attention and the tools and the focus that it needs so that it can heal itself.
Okay, so let's say in theory I come into you with back pain.
Right.
Okay, in a theoretical example.
Right.
Okay, so you talk to the theoretical patient. Let's call her Yosefa.
Right.
Okay, and she comes in with back pain. And what do you do? What do you do with her?
Right. So so back pain is a great example, and it's also a very common example.
Yeah.
And it's a great example because it's already entered into the mainstream view that back pain is not only physical, right?
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Sarno and his work has been around for many, many years. I actually don't necessarily incorporate his specific ideas, but I know that, you know, I know about his work, and people will come to me and say, you know, I read Dr. Sarno's book. But so again, if somebody came to me, I would try to figure out, okay, where is this back pain coming from, right? For someone, for one person, it might be that there's a lot of stress in their life, right? And that's, again, a very conventional view that when people are feeling stressed, it goes to their back, right? It goes to their neck, it goes to their lower back. That's really, but what if a person was in a car accident many, many years ago and there's something left over from that, some misalignment that's actually physical and not necessarily emotional, or maybe it's physical because they were in the car accident and then there's a piece of emotional trauma that's also connected to that. So we need to kind of work on that as well, right? The emotional piece and the physical piece, obviously. And the magic of the acupuncture is that when I use the needles, they don't differentiate between what's emotional and what's physical, right? The acupuncture points are just really manipulating and regulating the flow of electrical magnetic information in the body. And that is not, it's not, you know, in your body, it's not experienced as mind or body, it just is. So that the acupuncture ends up being a treatment for both, which I really love.
Can I throw in the word chi?
You know, I was trying to avoid the word chi.
I know, but I have a lot of respect for our listeners. So if they're still with us at this point, they can handle the word chi. Why don't you talk? You used electromagnetic energy, right? Is that a Western translation of the word chi?
Yes.
Okay, right. Chi is these energy forces that we have in our body. This is my rudimentary knowledge of Chinese medicine. But you find that, well, it's very helpful that these terms now have, you know, I would say evidence-based, right? There's the most Western research has been done on acupuncture, meaning that's one of those things that's been put into the main, you know, the almost main cell, you know, sort of whatever in our toolbox of treatments. So do you think it's not important for you as a practitioner? Do you have to know? You don't have to know what it is that's there, but you just know that there is a physical and perhaps emotional component. Like, you're not doing any, I don't know, psychological analysis of them when they're walking in, are you?
I'm not sure what you mean by the term psychological analysis.
Do they have to describe for you what they've experienced, or can you sense it even if they don't tell you?
That's a really interesting question that I'm not sure I've thought about so much. Because in the case of the back pain, so it might really be just physical, and there might be an emotional component. And again, often the needle will take care of both. Again, I'll ask questions, right? A lot of times uncovering like an emotional piece is not necessarily me intuiting something, but just really like telling the story, right? You know, that's like the first piece of the puzzle is hearing the story from the person. And I'll ask, so what happened in the, you know, 6 months to a year before you started to feel this symptom? Because oftentimes the key is right there, out in the open. You just have to like ask. Mm-hmm.
Right. A lot of times people, I mean, I've learned to ask these questions, not from acupuncture, from a different sort of discipline that I use most of the time. It's an unbelievable question to ask people because so many times we're going through life. This, by the way, brings me right back to Tzaraat and all those things we said earlier. But we so often don't connect the pieces.
Mamash.
It's unbelievable. And I'm talking about like intelligent, aware people, is that we often just don't, like, it's like two Lego pieces that like we just don't connect them together. And I would just say, by the way, in teaching and in like one-on-one conversations with students, I would say 90% of the time I ask them this question. Like when they'll come to talk to me about something and I'll say, what was happening before? Or what was the surrounding circumstance? Because for some reason, we often take things out of context when it comes to, I would even say mostly ourselves. Like we often, because we're in ourselves, we have a hard time seeing ourselves in context. So if there was like an accident or something that was, you know, clear, then that wasn't connected to a prior event, then that's one thing. But very often, like our lives, you know, they're not really so linear. Like there's all these levels that are connected. And 100%. We often, because we're inside of ourselves, have a hard time putting those things together. And I agree with you, meaning so often I find with students, I'm not talking about physical issues. Like we'll have a conversation, they're like, oh, okay, I didn't think about that. Like, I didn't think, right, how all these pieces might have been connected. Or I would say, honestly, also what happened, I do a lot with kalot because I have to do some sort of physical history with them when they come to speak with me. And it's a very, very important question. I would just say, even just for life, like when you're experiencing something, like just like take a moment to take a broader picture, even just ask a friend or a spouse and be like, wait, like maybe I'm not seeing, right, talk about that Ivaron and the Tzfat Emet, like, I'm not really seeing the picture. Something else must be like triggering this. Like we're not usually out of the blue humans unless it's like a physical freak accident kind of thing. You know, things come in context.
I think that what I'm discovering the more that I treat people is that hahefech, the body's actually super intelligent and almost like logical. Like there's usually really great explanations to why the body is behaving the way that it is. And we just have to understand it and then help it. I think that like intelligence, you know, again, when something goes wrong, we're always like, there's something wrong with the body. And
we look at it as failing us.
Yeah.
As opposed to speaking
and
with us.
Exactly. But the body is really just utilizing the information that's been given and responding oftentimes, I would say most of the time, really appropriately. It just might be a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm discovering, which I find really interesting, that, you know, like, wow, it makes a lot of sense, you know, why this would happen. I just had a patient come in recently. She has hypothalamic amenorrhea. So
translation?
Yeah. So she isn't getting her period, right?
Okay.
And, you know, and she's in her 20s, so she got her period and then it kind of went away. And she's been to a lot of different practitioners and nothing's really working, right? So so she came to me as like a last-ditch effort. And I started to use actually the technique, this newest technique that I learned, which is this allergy elimination technique, which is a combination between Chinese medicine and something called kinesiology, which is muscle testing. And it's really, really interesting. Anyway, so we started to do the first treatment, which was this what called the brain-body balancing technique. It's the first treatment in the series of allergy treatments. And as we're going through, basically what ends up happening is your muscle leads you to all the years where you have emotional blockages like are built up in your body. And as we went through her life, we realized that there were a lot of traumas that she had gone through, and it was actually perfectly logical and understandable, and actually made 100% sense why her body stopped menstruating, which I thought was really interesting. So
can you just maybe explain, you know, the word trauma gets thrown around a lot in the world today. Can you explain what you mean by that? Are you talking about small t, talking about things that impact our body that have resonate that don't just like sort of, you know, slip off our shoulders? What do you mean when you say that?
So I would say that in her specific case, she had big G traumas that were really sitting, I think, and blocking her hypothalamus in terms of its ability to regulate her hormones properly. But when I do the NAAT treatments, and we talk about these emotional blockages, it could be small T traumas, right? Classic ones are, you know, if somebody has some kind of trauma, I'm going to call it emotional blockage, you know, between 0 and 5. So unless there's something out of the ordinary that they know happened, I'll say, did your mother have a baby? You know, is there, right. You know,
life disruptors.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you go to God? Meaning these are things we all go through.
Yeah.
And I think that life disruptor is a great way, a great title for them. And I think they're all part of necessary things that happen to us that allow us to individuate as people, mm-hmm. right? We need those little disruptors to help us become ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't leave a mark on the body.
Yeah. So, first of all, I just want to say that as you speak, I just want to also, I don't know if it's explain or just, I'll tell you also over the years, what I, you know, once you start seeing physical ailments or physical manifestations of our bodies through these perspectives. So for me, it's actually been impossible to go back to other modalities. It's like anything, you know, like when you learn a parak of Torah and like you learn a new commentary and then you can't unsee it.
Yes.
So I feel that way about looking at our health like this. Now, do things always add up? Do we always know what a root cause is? Do those life disruptors, it doesn't mean you have to then look back at them with guilt or someone made a mistake. None of those things. I feel like that sometimes can be part of like the journey of like the messy journey in the beginning until you sort of learn to use these modalities, I think, like in a healthier way. Not everything is about blaming people, right? Not everything.
Nothing is about blaming. It's right. All about just trying to understand the context.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to say one other thing, and then you reminded me of something else I wanted to say, which is that, you know, you in the beginning you were describing your journey kind of in very oblique terms into this world of healing. And I think that for me, it also connects to being like also a kid who I was always a wisdom seeker. And you know, it used to be not so long ago that physicians combined a lot of these other kinds of modalities that today, because they're not evidence-based in the way that we think of it, they don't include them. We have now functional medicine. We have physicians like that. It's less prominent in Israel, certainly if we're going to walk into the kupa. But for me, it becomes very hard for me to go and sit with someone, I'll say particularly with my children, who I feel isn't looking at them broadly. Put aside the fact that they have 7 minutes to talk to them, but like who isn't looking at their health as part of like a broader context. And also I think everyone on the podcast knows that I really value intelligence. I value clarity of thought. But specifically when it comes to like our physical, mental, emotional health, at this point, it's critical for me that it be a combination of intelligence and wisdom. And I feel that the ways that we are raising physicians a lot of times in the world today is not necessarily to cultivate that kind of wisdom. And I agree, there could be people who have wisdom and who are lacking in their modalities. And those are practitioners that I also wouldn't go to with myself or my children. But at this point, my standard has become so high that like I need somebody who does both. And I've budgeted for that. Like I've made choices about, you know, clothing I don't want to buy because I actually prefer to take my kid, you know, to X practitioner. Meaning it's become that, it's that significant for me and us as a family. The other piece I just wanted to add is that while the world has become more amenable, especially if you're an English speaking audience, to the world of therapy, the thing that I love about these modalities of healing is that therapy, which can obviously be life-saving, critical, and important, it can also be destructive and unhelpful, okay? Just like any kind of healing, it could not do its job. It's a tremendous amount of energy. It's not only time and money, it's it's very draining to go through a therapeutic process. And the thing that I love about all these modalities, whether it's acupuncture or different Chinese medicine, or it's different avenues, whether it's homeopathy or different modalities that combine all these different disciplines together, look at the body and emotional health as one big package, as you said, the body doesn't differentiate. Is that a lot? The work can happen without it being cognitively aware. Because a lot of time the cognitive awareness of going through, like mm-hmm. I speak about that when people come to me and ask yeah. for advice about where to go. I said, okay, in a therapeutic process, you could go through that. And there's body healing, there's somatic therapy. There's lots of different, you know, again, ways out there that one can pursue, but it's a lot of aware cognitive work. And mm-hmm. the thing about the kind of work you do, which can touch upon like emotional spaces or emotional traumas that are caught in people's bodies in different places, is that you don't necessarily have to go in there and attack it and live through it again, or do you know what I'm saying? Or remove it from the body. It could be done like this. And I think it's such an amazing thing, because on this podium of sort of worshiping therapy that the world has come to today, people forget that it's time consuming, it's expensive, and it's very, very draining for people. And it can drag up things that they don't necessarily want to think about consciously. And this kind of healing can sort of circumvent the cognitive. Does that make any sense what I'm saying?
No, it's really interesting that you're saying that. There's a specific school of acupuncture where using what they call extraordinary vessels. So it's using acupuncture meridians that are not the usual acupuncture meridians that everybody's familiar with. And these treatments have a very, very strong vibrational power. And they're really meant to help people move out of like specific emotional like patterns. Mm-hmm. And so one of the treatments actually is to help people let go of pain from the past. And it's really interesting because I was treating somebody using this technique, which, by the way, you diagnose also through, you know, talking to the person, but also through pulses. So I can always check myself. Do they have a pulse that would lead me to use this specific vessel? And it was very helpful. He was going through therapy and really trying to let go of some of his traumas from the past, and was really kind of stuck. And we did this treatment over a number of weeks, and suddenly it was like, oh, I'm feeling so much better. So it's really interesting that you worded it that way. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, we talk a lot about the trauma and the trauma being caught, you know, stuck in the body. And it's, I think it's pretty much accepted nowadays that most trauma therapy involves a somatic element, because just talking is not enough really to help a person move past it.
It doesn't access the places in our brain that we actually store traumatic memories. And so there are other, I'm just explaining for the audience, okay. there are other modalities that are used. Somatic therapy is like a catchphrase for a lot of different ways. There's different kinds of ways to focus in those spaces that don't necessarily involve. It's not just talk therapy. That's right. Not the kind of therapy that will help people sort of release those.
Right. And sometimes it's elements. Talk therapy with a somatic intervention.
Yes.
You know, like the EMDR, right? Yeah. The eye movement therapy, or the tapping that I do is also. But and I think that that's, you know, an important thing to be aware of. But I want to just mention that sometimes, not necessarily trauma, but sometimes people can experience what we think is something wrong with their emotional health, and it's really coming from their body. So I just think this is a really interesting case. Somebody, I had a young woman come to me. She was actually sent to me by her psychiatrist because the medications weren't working for her. And, you know, she was having basic common anxiety symptoms, you know, palpitations, racing heart, trouble falling asleep, and like the obsessive thoughts. And, you know, we started to work with acupuncture, and that helped, you know, with the symptoms of the racing heart and the sleep. But and then I started to incorporate the allergy elimination techniques. And I don't know, one day I was looking at her and I noticed that her two front teeth were like a different color. And I asked her about it, and she said she had implants put in. And I don't remember why. But when we looked back at the timeline, when did you start experiencing the anxiety? And when did you get the implants? Like, she couldn't quite remember, but it was both of them were around 7 years ago. And I started treating her for the teeth, right? Because I didn't mention this. I do I also do something called German auricular medicine, which is basically acupuncture on the ear, and it's not Chinese, it's actually European, and it's very much Western-based, and the points have all been verified using fMRIs that they actually affect the brain directly. And there's a lot of talk about treating the teeth. So I started treating her teeth, and that was the final piece of then her obsessive thoughts went away.
Wow.
So it's just interesting. You know, we always think about how, you know, we always think that, okay, where is the trauma stuck in the body?
But,
you know, like,
you're saying could start with a physical situation.
Yeah, it's not, it's sometimes it could be body affecting the emotional health.
Yeah. Wow, that's such an interesting example.
So I work a lot with fertility patients. Yeah. And I think everybody knows that, you know, when women go through the process of infertility, that there's a lot of anxiety that comes along with the process. But, you know, this kind of brings us back to Tezria, right?
Right.
this kind of pulls together what we've just been talking about. I think when we work with fertility, we have to really look for the root cause on many different fronts. And so I have this one case was really, really fascinating. This woman who, she was a single mom. She wanted to become a single mom. And, but she was conflicted about becoming a single mom because of her own childhood. And she had started the IVF process, and she was already advanced enough in her age that she had a little bit diminished ovarian reserve and wasn't getting very many eggs when they were doing the stimulation. And she came to me and basically said, okay, I'm going to go do another cycle in 2 months. Like, we had 2 months to work together. It was like really, really intense. And we worked on all levels, right? We did the acupuncture, and I gave her the herbs, and we changed her diet, and I did the allergy elimination techniques, and we worked a lot on her beliefs about, could she be a single mother? Was it okay to be a single mother? And we ended up working on trauma stuck in the uterus, which I find oftentimes is a huge block for fertility patients. And, you know, it turned out that she'd had a number of abortions in her past, and we needed to kind of, you know, using my skills, release each of those traumas, because those were all blocks to her ability to become pregnant and carry the pregnancy. And she ended up going back after 2 months of work, which I'm going to say is not so much time when you're trying to prepare a body for the fertility process. And it was just unbelievable. Like, they did the ovarian stimulation. They took out a lot of eggs. The first embryo they put back in stuck. She did not have a miscarriage. And within 11 months of our starting to work together, she had a baby, which was incredible. So I just think that's a great story where we used everything, right? I gave her the Chinese herbs to help, you know, balance her hormones. We worked with the acupuncture to bring blood flow to the uterus, but we also worked a lot on any kind of emotional blocks from these life disruptors that actually were preventing her from becoming pregnant.
You ever have cases where you say, this is beyond my toolbox? I can't help.
Not a lot, because you can always, I think
you can always help a bit.
Right, exactly. Right. I think that I've had cases where I felt like, you know what, I'm just not getting this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's time to go to someone else.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm not the person.
Mm-hmm. And just so that our audience is clear, meaning acupuncture specifically, like, is something you would recommend for, do you have like a list of things that you say, you know?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, acupuncture is medicine. So if it's something that you need medical care for, then acupuncture can help with it, right?
Right. But Ritalin is medicine. And if I have, low ovarian reserve, low egg reserve, I'm not going to take Ritalin. So meaning different medicine could be many things, but it's not necessarily right for every issue.
Oh, it's true. But I guess I'm saying, as a modality, it can give a ma'ane.
Mm-hmm. Or it can give some sort of
response to all types of...
Right.
Disease.
Right.
I specifically focus on treating women's health issues, pain throughout the body, gastro issues, and now I work a lot with allergies.
Mm-hmm.
But you name it, and acupuncture could be helpful with it. I don't particularly work with issues with eyes, but I know somebody who specializes in acupuncture for eyes.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so you're saying it's a whole modality that, you know, when we say medicine, we don't mean a medicine, like I just said. We mean pill taking is a method, right? Meaning utilizing oral medication is a method. So acupuncture is a method that could be used for all these
I meant when you think about conventional medicine as being, you know, as the medical establishment is there to, you know, help people, I guess, heal disease or fight disease. So Chinese medicine is an entire system and it treats everything, you know, even cancer, right? In Israel, I don't really think any practitioner would treat cancer per se. They treat the side effects of the treatments for cancer.
Yeah.
But in other places in the world, people are trained to use acupuncture to heal cancer. Hmm. I don't do that, right?
Right.
But there are people who do that.
Wow. Okay, I guess as we wind down this really fascinating conversation, I wanted to ask you, I want to sort of circle back to this Torah idea. And I'm just wondering if any of kind of like the modalities or the disciplines you've learned or been exposed to over the years, you know, how do you find them coalescing or maybe sometimes having tension with, do they at all have tension, do you feel like with your Torah life? Maybe it's like an old school way of thinking, but like, you know, people think of like yoga and like if it's deeply connected to some of the original beliefs of yoga, like, let's be honest, a lot of them do not at all. I practice yoga, but not in like the from sense, you know?
Right.
So that's not at all what's sitting, I think, at the root of the modalities you're using, but, or maybe, meaning maybe they are. Where does that fit in there?
So I have to say that, you know, that is a question that I struggled with at the beginning. Chinese medicine, like yoga, has a lot of religion at its very core. And I have to say that personally, I tend to stay away from those core learnings. I don't delve into them so much. I stay more with the practical part of the Chinese medicine and the acupuncture, which, as you said, has been researched and is pretty much evidence-based at this point.
Yeah. You don't need to dabble in the beliefs? Not a belief of the medicine?
So it's really interesting because I feel like there are different parts. Just like you could do yoga, right? And you could utilize the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
And you can do a sun salutation without believing that you're bowing down to the sun, right? So you can use, because most of the Chinese medicine is actually very scientific. There is a book that at its core, it's kind of like at the core of Chinese medicine, you know, very, very, very old, that I haven't yet read. Maybe I will one day. It's called the I Ching. And that's much more like nichush, you know, a lot of like future telling and things like
divinations.
That. Yeah, divinations, exactly. Yeah. But I would say after that work, most of the works in Chinese medicine, even if they have like, I'm going to use the word spiritual, right? They have a spiritual component. If you want to read like Lao Tse and, you know, and the ideas about the Tao, those are really easy for me to kind of understand and to incorporate. And I don't feel like they conflict so much with my Torah values because I've learned how to kind of take them with a grain of salt and kind of reframe them from where, you know, from my own perspective. But it is true that the Chinese way is very different from the Torah way. Mm-hmm. And the first book that was written by a Westerner on about Chinese medicine in the 1970s was called The Web That Has No Weaver.
What?
And, you know, so that speaks volumes, right? So I feel like the Chinese really do, they understand the connections. They understand that there is a force that is moving things. And I think of that as immanence, right? Like this, I think they do that really well. Like it's just part of the medicine. It's not like a separate thing. It's not like the mind-body divide. It's like, it's all one, right? Go back to the chi, it's all one, right? And they talk a lot about the connections between heaven, man, and earth. Like that's just part of the discussion. It's part of Chinese medicine. Points have those names. You'll have a trio of points, and one is the point that's the heaven aspect, a point that's the earth aspect, and point that's the man aspect. And I find that to be something that's very understandable from my perspective. They don't do transcendence well, right? There's no concept of like, you know, God in the way that we view a transcendent God in the world. But I would like to say that at the end of the day, if I put all of that aside, I think that we just get back to the idea that I mentioned before, which is that, you know, the body, the way Hashem created it, has the ability to heal itself. And I just view that as Hashem's gift to us. And to me, that's really when we say Ani Hashem Rofecha, when we utilize it, then we're just, I'm just using that power of Ani Hashem Rofecha like on a daily basis.
Bati, thank you so much for coming here and speaking with me about all these things. I value you as a as a practitioner. And I think that there are like many, many wonderful, I've met so many wonderful people practicing in Israel and really helping people to bring, you know, their physical and I would say spiritual, but I mean of the spirit elements to places of healing. So thank you in the name of all of that. And thanks for coming here today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all Women's Torah Learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.